Tatanam in sutra.
We say every day, and I think everybody knows that. And we have people work on it as koan material, so that's. I won't go into that because I think almost everyone here has worked on that, except Jen, and you'll get it soon. Okay, so let's begin with the verse of the Kesa. And let's just, with bells.
This is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction.
Begin sitting at 6 a.m. and we begin sitting with the verse of the Kesa, which means that the first word we say together as a group every morning of a retreat is vast. Vast. And I've been meditating on this chant now since the beginning of this retreat, and I can hardly get beyond the word vast. It's unimaginably vast. The word itself is vast. Vast is the robe of liberation. Vast, we say the ocean is vast. We say the fields of wheat in the great plains are vast. We say the sky is vast. And we say the robe of the Buddha is vast. The robe of liberation. Tartong Tulku is a Tibetan teacher who lives in California. I had the good fortune to study with him briefly. And he wrote a book, which I like very much, called Time, Space, and Knowledge. And the first sentence of that book is, wherever we go, there is always the sky. As far as I'm concerned, he could have stopped the book right there. There's always the sky. There's always this infinite reality. All we have to do is look up. And we, I don't know how many of you have spent a good part of your youth like I have, lying on your back watching the clouds. And you lose yourself. You really do, if you let yourself just do that. And the night sky, going out and just watching the stars at night. It changes us. It pulls us into a different reality, a vast reality, an infinite reality. And we realize maybe how small our lives are, but how huge the possibilities are. Vast is the robe of liberation. Now the robe we're referring to is this, which is hardly big enough to make a decent baby's bib. You can hardly call this vast. And yet this is the small kesa, the small Buddha robe. And it's called a raksu. And the Buddha was walking in the mountains with Ananda, his attendant, and they were looking down and saw the rice fields, the rice paddies. And he said to Ananda, I want you to design a robe for our monks, for our sangha, that looks like these rice paddies. And if you come and look at one of these closely, you'll see that it's all divided unevenly into little squares and stripes, like rice paddies are. And on every one of the ones that people have, I guess only three people in the room are wearing rapsus these days, is written this verse. Vast is the road. And they traditionally are made, or were made, from pamsula. Pamsula means anything that's cast off, anything that has been thrown away. And so the monks traditionally went to the graveyards and took the clothes from the rotting corpses, the bodies at that time weren't buried, they were simply exposed, and the animals and birds came and ate them. And they came and took the tattered and rotten clothing and made their robes out of that. Mercifully, we don't do it that way here and now, but...
More is a pity.
So this is the vast robe, and the slightly vaster robe is the what we wear here only for services, and it's that piece that goes around and under the shoulder and ties here. It's not the whole enchilada, it's just that robe on the outside, which is called that is the real kesa. And it is about the size of a beach towel, so it's not really too vast either. It's a little vaster than this, but not a whole lot. So we say vast is the robe of liberation. A robe of liberation is kind of an odd concept too. I mean, how can a robe liberate? A robe protects us from the sun, keeps us warm in the winter, but how does it liberate? How is there a robe of liberation? Well, if we go on with the verse, we'll come back to this robe of liberation, but a formless field of benefaction. A formless field. Like a magnetic field, maybe, or an energy field. Some kind of field that spreads through the whole universe and is formless. Hard to imagine. And it's a field of benefaction. Now, benefaction is an odd word that's not found in every dictionary. I looked in three until I found it. But it's, of course, the root of it is bene, the Italian and originally Latin word for blessing. And it's a field of benefaction, a field of benefit, a field of generosity, a field of giving. This is the Buddha robe. This is it. It's this infinite field of kindness, of giving. And it is because it is this infinite field of kindness that it is a robe of liberation. We are celebrating the liberation of the Buddha and his teaching that gives us the potential to be liberated. But there's only one thing we need to be liberated from, and that's ourselves. Which is also interesting. I wear the Tathagata's teaching. Is the third line. The Tathagata is one of the names of the Buddha. It supposedly is what he called himself. And depending on how you pronounce it, it means either the thus born one or the thus come one. Agata means come, and Tata always means thus, and that the gata means gone, and the, if you accent the agata, then it means come. So the one word means the two things. But the Buddha described himself as the thus gone one, the one who has gone a particular way, has let go of his own self clinging, has let go really of his own self-identity, and has, you know, it's we in the Heart Sutra at the end we chant that gate gate para gate para samgate, which means gone, gone, completely gone, gone to the other shore. And so that is what they're talking about, what this Tathagata is talking about, of having left everything, of having let go of everything in order to obtain realization. And because of that, leaving everything, are able to realize. But it doesn't mean leaving in the ordinary sense. Although it did for him. I mean, he walked away from his wife and newborn son. But it isn't necessary. And then I wear the Tathagata's teaching. I wear his teaching. Isn't that an odd thing to say? And yet, we do clothe ourselves in the teaching, in that teaching of impermanence is the very first thing he taught. Nothing is permanent. And it's our desire for things to be permanent that causes all this suffering that we go through. I'm in love with Rosie, in case someone hasn't noticed. And she's an old, old dog. And I don't know how much longer she's going to hold out. She's doing way better than I thought she would. But I don't want her to die. I really don't. And I think I'm causing both of us suffering by that desire of mine, by my inability to just say, do what you need to do and I'll be okay. I wear the Tathagata's teaching, the teaching of impermanence, the realization that nothing stays the same, even for 1 second, nothing stays the same. And accepting that and rejoicing in that. And it's that teaching that saves all sentient beings. It's not that we need saving. We're already saved, if you will. I find saving perhaps an odd translation into English of what, I don't know what the original word in the Sanskrit was, but freeing perhaps might be a better term. And those of us who have rakshus or cases, when we first put them on in the morning, you've seen us, the first time we put them on during the day, you've seen those of us who have them kind of walk off into a corner and put them on our heads. And here in the Zendo, when we're out chanting, we put them on our heads. And what we're doing is chanting this verse before putting it on for the day. For the first time in the day. And we put it on our head as an acknowledgement that this is our teaching, that this represents our teacher, and that we accept the teaching of the Buddha as our teacher. And we accept Shakyamuni's teaching, Shakyamuni himself as our teacher. Are there any questions? Yes, Deborah.
Well, I think it's odd that you characterize every line as odd. is that what makes one of the things that makes it particularly significant or particularly incisive?
Well, it's an odd way of speaking to our ears. Vast is the robe of liberation. Vast is this piece of... It's this little dinky piece of cloth made of littler, dinkier pieces of cloth. And yet there's this understanding behind that, that the robe of liberation is not just this piece of cloth. It is that, but it's this whole... spread throughout history, throughout the universe, throughout all space and time of that teaching.
And we have had to get someplace before we are able to wear the rakshu. So we have, in some small way, come to understand part of that liberation.
Perhaps. There are some centers that are much nicer than ours where you could go and you say, I want Jukai, and they just give you one. And they say, okay, you've had Jukai. We make you work overtime for it.
Seems more reasonable. I mean, it gives it more meaning. Gives the rakshu more meaning.
I think so. But the way it's worded, I wear the Tathagata's teaching. I wear the Tathagata's teaching. Doesn't that strike you as unusual? It's an odd thing to say.
It's a symbol.
Hmm?
You're wearing a symbol.
I know, but I wear the teaching. It doesn't say I'm wearing the case, it says I wear the teaching. I think it's so beautiful. I wear the teaching. And when I remember that I am clothed in that, my life changes. Let's chant. We got the Tishrani. We first chant it twice in Pali, and you can tell it's Pali and not Sanskrit because there's no R in the Dharma. So Pali drops all those R's and it's Dhamma. I'm going to ask you how you understand this. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. What does that mean to you?
That we need some things to ground us, otherwise we'll be lost.
It's also our awareness of the three treasures, which is such a central part of Zen.
Of all of Buddhism, actually.
And trying to let go of everything else except.
It's a very comforting verse. It's a very warm verse. Yeah, I have a pimple. Sometimes I don't come because I'm so busy, and sometimes I don't come because I'm so tired. I can't even fathom getting in my car again. But today I left a husband with no dinner, and I came straight from the goats. I can smell the goats in me, and Rosie smelled it in me too. And yet, it's this, I haven't practiced in a while, and yet it's this incredible comfort, and very, it's just such a
Every time, it's such a feeling of coming home. Kyle.
Refuge definitely pulls you out of deep waters into a place where you can stand. Definitely. So, very important. It's not a refuge with an electric fence around it. All the things you need refuge from come and visit you. And I for me, it's like it's what sitting is that there's something about sitting that allows you to experience more of your life more directly, so you don't avert from it. So everything comes up. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about a session is basically all the tapes get played, and it's a wonder the amount of bullshit that happens in my head. And, but this is the place for that to happen, to see it. So.
Crap's last tape.
Yeah, Crap's last tape. Yes.
What?
It's recently produced.
It's a Beckett play.
Yeah. I guess I see it as I give my life to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
In a number of traditions, just saying that those three lines three times makes you a Buddhist. The Tibetans, that's what you, if you want to become Buddhist, you say that, those three lines. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And they call it taking refuge. They call becoming a Buddhist taking refuge. I always find it interesting, if I have taken refuge, that makes me a refugee. And the question always arises in my mind, what am I a refugee from? And I think I'm with Peter, all the garbage that goes on in my mind is... Again, these are very powerful words. In the very earliest sanghas, the Buddha himself, if somebody said, I want to be a monk, he said, come bhikkhu. Bhikkhu is monk in Sanskrit. Come bhikkhu. That was it. You didn't have to make your own case or nothing. Just come bhikkhu. But in the very earliest sanghas, after the death of the Buddha, it was that this is what they did. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And for me, it's anchoring myself there in the three treasures, anchoring myself in the Buddha. Both Shakyamuni and the much larger concept of the Buddha, the unborn Buddha mind, the teaching of the Buddha, the infinity of all of the enlightenment, if you will, of the wisdom, the infinity of the Buddha's concept, of the Buddha's teaching. I can't seem to find the word I want. I take refuge in the Dharma, of course, as I take refuge in the teaching of the Buddha. The Dharma is literally the teaching of the Buddha. But it's also all things.
I take refuge in all things. And I take refuge in the Sangha. And there, quite the most powerful meaning of Sangha is our little practice group. It's whatever group you practice with. So when I say I take refuge in the Sangha, I'm taking refuge in all of you. You are my Sangha. And I can't tell you how happy we are. What a wonderful Sangha. What a loving Sangha this is. But we take refuge in each other when we say this verse. And that's really all I have to say tonight.
When we take refuge in the Dharma, small d, that's very much related to the vast that you were talking about, the vast group. And so taking refuge is not a closing in. I mean, it's not a cutting off. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, usually the word taking refuge is kind of has an overtone of escaping from. And hence refugees. And, you know, I take refuge in a foreign country where I won't be hunted down.
But this does not have that sense at all.
I wonder if it might have more, I wonder if it's changed over time. When we talk about monastics, they may have seen it more as taking refuge from the world, and you know, as we become non-monastic Buddhists, it's much more about still being in the world. It's a different kind of refuge. I don't know.
For me, it's a place where I'm safe. No matter what happens, no matter who's after me, I'm safe with the Buddha, with the Dharma, with the Sangha. I'm protected. I feel protected. That's what it means to me.
It's like the mafia. Like the mafia.
Do I have something to say to you?
I was just going to add that also there's a definition of refuge as home.
Yes.
Yeah. But what my first comment was that I was like contemplating the fact that there's three treasures, and it just seems to me maybe when one is trying to deepen their practice, they might focus on the Dharma, for example, or on the Buddha, or on the Sangha. But you need like all three, and so I was just thinking about that, about how sometimes we might get caught up in one of the treasures.
In many, many of the world's religions, there are threes to be found: Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Three treasures. And two B's in there, three, two.
Dharmakaya, Bodhakaya,
and
Nimanakaya. The three bodies of the Buddha.
I was struck by your remark about in wherever you can say these and become a Buddhist, and how, and those are oral cultures where if you say something, a vow has a kind of resonance that in our fairly debased view, versions of vows in our culture, it's hard to summon up that amount of resonance. If you put your name to it, that's your whole being. And the importance of those vows in a less rationalized culture is really powerful. And I'm touched that you could have that happen in a culture and trust that that was all it needed to get done, all you needed to do was say.
And what's interesting is you need to say it three times.
Yeah.
And in order to become a Muslim, what you need to do is say La ilaha illallah wa Muhammadan Rasulallah 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if you do that with faith,
mm-hmm.
you are a Muslim.
And also divorce your wife if you say it 3 times.
Only for Jews. We're not that smart.
But you know, still in our culture, you know, vows aren't as important. Saying it 3 times to us, a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And every, you know, I don't say it all that much. But every time I say it, it's pretty powerful.
In
a way that nothing else
does. Yeah, I remember when I first started saying it, the Buddham Sharanam, I was always filled with gratitude. Like Steph said, that this is a safe place. And
I think saying it is a safe place to me makes me think of fear, because then it means that there's fear out there.
There is.
There is, yeah.
That's the reality. It's there.
I think we all live with tremendous amounts of fear. I mean, the fear that I'm not good enough, that's for starters. The fear that I won't have enough money, that, you know, all of my 401ks are tanked, which they have. The fear that our economy isn't going to recover. I mean, if there are a zillion things that we're all afraid of. And, I mean, there are people who have very real fears of their parents, very real fear of getting mental illness because it's in their families. I mean, on and on and on. And, you know, I think we all carry quite a bit of fear with us. I may be mistaken. I may be the only one in the room who does, but hardly. But it's a place where I can say that and say the Tisharan. And the fears don't matter when I say it. When I'm in that space, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. My 401ks have still tanked. But it doesn't matter. I'm okay. I'll be okay.
That reminds me of when I first came to Treetop and I was just a walking fear. And
now you're a pain in the neck.
It takes a long time for the three treasures to work on you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something that just...
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't have something like the three treasures to take refuge in, what do you have? You're reacting. You're just reacting to the world, and that's in that way lies madness.
I want to underscore what Margaret said about Sangha. We often, as she said, say, how did this happen that we're blessed with such a wonderful sangha? It's a caring sangha, it's a loving sangha, and lots of people who have come through and gone have said the same things to us about the sangha. This is very powerful, and it's not insignificant that the Sangha is right alongside the Dharma and the Buddha. It's not the third. They're all equal. You cannot have one without the other. And if the Sangha isn't present, the Buddha and the Dharma isn't present. And if the Buddha, I mean, they're all one. And for me, it's been a guideline for practice or studying with a student. And as you know, there are, throughout the year, many students have wanted to study with me or Margaret from a distance. And I tried it because I really wanted to try things. But what was missing was Sangha. And without Sangha, it's incomplete. It just never worked. Just now, Dennis, one of the inmates who studied with me, he wants to study with me. I said, it's not possible. And I asked him to check out other people, including Dido. Dido's place may be a good place for him. But it's important to work with the group, to be and to sit with the group, and to struggle together. You all feel it when you are together. The difference between the zazen you do alone at home and when you're here together is phenomenal. I feel it. So don't underestimate the strength and power and blessings we have of Sangha. I'm so thankful to you all.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to receive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.